beside us is the frontispiece to Princess of Mars by Frank Schoonover. Okay. The question is, 2016 Kansas City World Science Fiction Convention. I think I mentioned in a note to you, I'm putting together a panel, John Carter 2016. So I've talked to Stan, I've talked to Greg, now I'm talking to you, Michael Derda of the Washington Post. Put together a panel of appreciation of the character, what happened to him in the movie, and maybe where is the character going. Will you join us?
Well, the character's going to Mars.
I can tell you on the spot.
I certainly would like to go. I haven't planned my exact trajectory because I'm going to be in London at a family reunion earlier that month, but I could just fly directly back and get there in time. It starts August 17, I think.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that would be fun to be on. And Stan said he would be there?
He said he would try. Maybe he was being polite.
Yeah, he's always polite. He told
he
me once
unless he's hiking somewhere.
That he, well, he usually is hiking at that time. So am I. Because I have a place in the High Sierra. So he doesn't, but he goes up there to hike. I would like to because John Carter is that seminal figure. Notice he has a prior military career. Which was, turns out to be crucial because the Martians are not expecting double-armed combatants.
And it's appropriate that he would know about the god of war,
right,
Mars.
Right.
Well, the movie left that out.
Yes, I was very sorrowful at the movie. They did enough work to have made approximately three movies. There were so many scenes that were cut short and rendering it incoherent.
And so many references to sequels, which never came.
Right. It was tragic to see them waste so much, thinking that they could ditch all the grandeur of Mars and instead of and not hold long shots, so you've got to take in the majesty of the scene they constructed, and instead jump cut their way through an entire movie with short little scenes, mistaking it for some kind of exploding car movie. It's a notable failure.
Andrew Stanton seemed to have the right spirit going into the project,
yes.
But something happened.
He overspent and underthought the whole movie. A counterexample of someone who actually made something out of very little is Ex Machina, the film.
Right.
Where he deliberately shot it like a Stanley Kubrick movie in which he forces you to simply look at this scene and this strange object in the scene and think about it and see the context and look at the subtleties of movement. And that's actually, it turns out, a very inexpensive way to shoot a movie, too.
And grafting it onto the Bluebeard tale.
Exactly. I thought Ex Machina was certainly the best SF film I've seen in quite a while. Another example, not quite as fine, I think, is Predestination, which appeared in, I think, February of this year, 2015, and is a complete make, not a remake, of All You Zombies by Heinlein. Really worth seeing. And the entire film, shot supposedly, you know, on locale in the United States, was actually shot entirely in Melbourne, Australia, with Ethan Hawke and a small cast, for an astonishingly small budget, as I recall, less than $1 million. Whereas the John Carter movie, what, $100 million, something like that?
Should we be grateful it got made at all?
No. You know, should we be grateful that at least we got the Titanic halfway across the Atlantic? I don't think so. because the ship sinks and then you don't get to do it again.
Well, it's interesting that from Ray Bradbury to Carl Sagan, they both talk about being out there as a kid on the lawn with their arms outstretched towards Mars. Isn't that wonderful?
It is. Of course, I did the same thing. But my heroic figure in fiction were those of the Heinlein juveniles, which really made me very interested in a scientific career. And Tom Corbett came from that. And Tom Corbett, I was living in Japan at the time, so I actually didn't see any Tom Corbett. I did see a little bit afterward of Captain Video. I think Corbett came first.
Yeah.
Captain
Video was on radio, but it was not a space story yet. He was kind of an adventurer,
right.
And he went to space later.
Right. Right. I saw it in the TV mode when my father was at Fort McPherson in Atlanta.
Isn't
briefly.
It interesting that small screen, that god-awful looking image, could put such a hold on our imagination?
Well, something is always better than nothing.
Teeny tiny little postage stamp screen for you.
I know. When I see people, as I did recently on a subway in some city, looking at a movie on a phone, I think, you know, you're kind of abusing the medium here. I mean, I did that because it was the only thing possible, but it's like reading War and Peace on your phone. What?
Try and explain that to the students.
You mean the short attention span students who are waiting for the end of the sentence?
And the limited grasp or need or ambition to look at an image.
Yeah.
It's beyond this.
Right.
It's ridiculous.
It's very strange.
Or to look at images where it's all stretched and nobody has thought to change the aspect ratio.
That true. That true. 2001, to me, was the first great spectacle movie that I thought really knocked you over. Of course, there was always Lawrence of Arabia, too.
Well, but before we leave the Mars thing, The Martian Race, talk to me about that book now and about The Martian, which has yet to... Well, I've seen it already. You probably have not.
I have not.
But you read the book or know about it?
Yes, I read it.
So, The Martian Race... John Carter, The Martian Race, The Martian. Connective tissues here?
I co-wrote The Martian Race, actually, with Elizabeth Malartra, who is now my wife. But I collaborated with her on that because she was very interested in Martian biology, and she actually is a biologist. And so we co-invented a subsurface form of Martian life that's very interesting. And the striking thing to me is that the outstanding question on Mars now is that actually possible? Because otherwise, it's very hard to explain the methane emissions we have now measured directly on the surface, but were detected from orbit about 8 years ago. Because the only known mechanism that tends to explain it is subsurface life. That's the major source of the methane in our atmosphere, which converts on a scale of a year over to CO2. But in the Martian atmosphere, it both appears in bursty ways. It'll go up and down at a given location in a matter of just weeks. And it's not compatible with our understanding of the Martian atmosphere in the first place. That is, the rate of processes, rate of breakdown in methane is faster than our models say it should occur. And so something's off. My suspicion is that there's some absorption in the chlorates in the soil, which we still don't understand, but we do know is there.
So many of your stories depend upon something is off.
Yeah. Well, it's been my experience in science is that science seen in films typically is focused on the eureka moment, but in real science, discoveries typically are moments when you say, hey, that's funny. Yeah, it's not eureka, I have solved it, but that's really odd, that's out of place, what's going on? That it's the suspicion that something is a kilter that more often heralds a discovery.
But back to Martian Race.
Martian Race. But the point is, Martian Race attacked two things. One, I thought the issue of life on Mars had been swept aside by the Viking experiments, an unjustified sweep, I thought, mostly due to one guy at Caltech and his interpretation of the data. But the second is, no one really expected even then surface life, if only because of the high UV rate. But subsurface life made sense because by then and now we knew that the origins of surface water on Mars were much earlier than they were on the Earth because the cooling off time is faster. Earth is bigger, cools off slower, but Earth was also hit by a Mars-sized object shortly after its origins, which rekindled all the heating and blew off whatever volatiles were on the surface. So we know that Mars had probably several hundred million years head start on Earth. And if life evolves fairly spontaneously in the right conditions, then Mars certainly had a good chance to begin life. And then over a period of another few hundred million years, The atmosphere slowly bled away because the Martian magnetic field began to fail and stopped screening out solar storms, which hit the water in an atmosphere and break it into hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen escapes, oxygen gets locked up in the iron in the sand, and that's why Mars is red. What you're seeing on a red Mars is the death of the Martian atmosphere. It has painted the surface. Nobody ever seems to want to mention this. Why is Mars red?
Certain elegiac quality to the beautiful.
That's right. It's kind of a dying swan metaphor. But I always thought, so Martian life might well be there. And people talk about things like, let's go drill into Europa and see if there's life in that ocean. Well, honey, you can walk into a cave on Mars and get a good look at the subsurface. But, by the way, you can only do that with a human, plausibly.
So for people who have not read it, what kinds of conclusions did you reach in Martian Race?
Well, the frame of the story is that NASA finally commits to a human expedition, and then some astronauts in a big booster in the late 20-teens, that is coming up close now, blows up on the launch pad, kills the astronauts, and NASA stands down. Meanwhile, they've developed a whole lot of this infrastructure. And so an entrepreneur notices in the background, to support the American program, there is a system that the Europeans actually used in the 1700s. It is the contractual theory of exploration. You say, we hear there's this place called Thailand. Well, if you go out there and you find it and you bring us back a ship full of local goods, we'll pay you so many thousand pounds. The British did that in order to push exploration and trade. Well, the nations of the world get together, five or six of them, and say, here's a Mars prize, it's $30 billion. You go to a manned expedition to Mars, you grab up a bunch of rocks, you do some studies, X, Y, Z, and you come back, we'll give you $30 billion. And a figure that I've actually based on several billionaires I know simply says, you know, here's this prize. Why don't I put together a program and I sell all the advertising and other rights while we're building a ship and going to Mars, and we have daily TV broadcasts from the crew. Yeah, I was way ahead of my time. It was published in 1999. And we make enough money out of just the video rights to probably earn back our investment, and then we get $30 billion when you come back. And that's the beginning of the novel. And they actually managed to discover life. And I've written actually several stories set in that same situation since. Indeed, I wrote one this year. It'll come out in FNSF in about 2 months, a story called Vortex, which Gordon Van Gelder asked me to write on the basis of a Bob Eggleton painting, which shows some space-suited figures in the middle of what looks like a tornado on the surface of Mars. So I wrote a story around it. I like doing that old kind of style of stuff.